You're listening to an episode of NARCAD's Core Podcast Series. For more information on academic detailing, visit us at narcad.org and stick around after this episode.
Well, this is Mike, and since this is our first podcast, there's a lot that we want to cover about academic detailing and where it fits in today's healthcare environment. But for anyone for whom the podcast is their first introduction to NARCAD, it might be helpful to hear a little bit from you, Jerry, about where academic detailing came from in the first place, now almost 40 years ago.
Okay, thanks, Mike. What listeners ought to know is that academic detailing is an attempt to, in a sense, market the very best evidence about medications or other clinical decisions to doctors. It started back in the early 80s when then early in my training, I noticed that drug companies seemed awfully good at marketing their products and were able to change physicians' decision-making pretty much at their will, whereas those of us in academia were more likely to be standing behind podiums giving dull lectures to a darkened auditorium of people. And the question that really got this whole field going for me was, would it be possible to actually be as sophisticated as the drug companies were in marketing the very best evidence instead of marketing just the products they were trying to sell, but use all those principles of interactivity and discussion and understanding where the learner was coming from to have one-on-one discussions with doctors in our offices about what we ought to be prescribing that was only an attempt to market evidence and not to market a given product. And that has taken off globally, and we now have programs around the world that are using that social marketing approach to promote only the best evidence rather than to just push product.
What we really, I think, could get into in this podcast is thinking about how academic detailing fits in the healthcare environment today. And one of the real challenges for all of us who care about evidence-based practice and who want to hold up those basic precepts that you talked about, Jerry, of identifying the best evidence and getting it to a clinician's in a way that they can use it, is the huge signal-to-noise problem that clinicians face right now, that there's so much information out there. Patients may be searching on the internet and getting information from all kinds of sources. And even in the larger sphere, there's more of a distrust of scientific expertise, which is really concerning to people like us who work in academic settings. So I guess I'd be interested in your take, Jerry, on how do we as people who are trying to implement and support academic detailing and really care about getting the evidence interpretation right to help clinicians, how do we convey to clinicians that we are a credible source, that the evidence we are bringing them is accurate and helpful in a way that can stand out from the mass of noise that's out there in today's communications world?
Mm-hmm. That's a vital question. One way to start is to just make it clear that this is really a bunch of idealistic clinicians who work at a medical school, in our case it happens to be Harvard, who are doing this through a variety of either university-based or nonprofit-based activities, often supported by grants from either state or federal governments, and we're not trying to sell a product, and none of us consults for any drug companies. And it takes a while, actually, to convince doctors of this when they're new to hearing about academic detailing. If one of our folks goes into their office, there's a lot of questioning about, yeah, but which drug company is really paying for this, or who really sent you, or is this about trying to save money for the government? And you know, the answer is no, no, and no. This really is just an attempt to make science available with no particular axe to grind, but just get the very best data out to doctors and other healthcare professionals so that we can all take better care of our patients.
Through NARCAD, we've definitely seen that challenge of establishing oneself as a credible source, and that that the academic detailer is not there either to be punitive or to load the usually primary care doctor up with another burden or another set of tasks that they have to do. Academic detailing can be a service to lots of different kinds of doctors, but by far the most common academic detailing interventions are to primary care clinicians. And for those clinicians, they're facing a lot of change recently, some of it well-intentioned, some of it feeling relatively negative. And those political discussions aren't our focus, But one of the things that makes me nervous when I talk to programs who are trying to implement academic detailing is that we can get so caught up in the current high-profile political debate that we lose sight of some of the really important challenges about communication. And what I'd like us to spend a few minutes getting into, Jerry, is the challenge of communication. And maybe we'll stick with drugs initially, although people use academic detailing for a lot of interventions. But the communication about drugs has been particularly a concern over the last few years as we think about whether some of the regulations that were in place to constrain what doctors and other clinicians can hear about drugs are getting watered down. And so what do you think about the role of academic detailing in this new communication environment for the last few years?
Okay, that's an important point, Mike. And it is an interesting time to be thinking about these issues, both on the micro level of what's in this morning's headlines, all the way to the longer term trends. And the longer term trends really have been in place for decades. That is, having spent many years of my own practice in primary care, and Mike, of course, does that to this day, the very great need that clinicians have for just having somebody say, so what is the story about the best way to manage hypertension or diabetes or congestive heart failure? You know, we know what the sales reps are telling us, and if we have time, we could read 100 journal articles and try to glean the truth. But this has been a need probably ever since the Hippocrates time to try to get a hold of the very best information where thoughtful people with no ulterior agenda just tried to pull it together and say, look, if you've only got 15 or 20 minutes to think about congestive heart failure and the latest findings, let me give it to you now. And we spent dozens and dozens of hours, as you know so well, Mike, in trying to develop these materials. Here's a 15 or 20 minute synthesis that we think boils down all the take-home points. And that's really been a need that physicians have had for centuries. You're engaged in active primary care practice for a large chunk of your time. How do these issues resonate with you from that perspective?
Well, the need for accurate information is always there. One of the challenges, I think, for any clinician that I think is especially true for primary care or other generalists where we are covering a wide range of topics and a patient may come to us with five different medical problems and they really, if you are the patient, you have those problems, you want them all addressed, and as their primary care doctor, I want to try to do that.
In a 12-minute visit.
And it can feel quite overwhelming. And we all want to feel that we're helping our patients. We all want to feel that we're doing a good job and know what to offer them. And it can be very challenging when the volume of evidence that you need to process feels overwhelming without even taking into account that the evidence may be conflicting and it's not just how much you have to read but sorting out what's the most accurate. I think that's a big contributor to why a lot of generalists and a lot of primary care physicians struggle with symptoms, if you like, of burnout. They're mm-hmm. just overwhelmed by what they have to do. And it's actually one of the reasons that we talk about in some of the slides and presentations that are on the website at narcad.org that often clinicians don't see evidence-based medicine as a positive for them. They see it as a burden and something else they have to do, and it's sort of one more load on their already overburdened task list. And so one of the challenges, I think, in academic detailing programs that we try to work with organizations to figure out is, how do you design a program, an academic detailing intervention, and how do you train your academic detailers so that they can come to a clinician, whether primary care or another specialty, and provide a service? I mean, these are some of the original principles, as you know, Jerry, that you and your colleagues outlined decades ago in the first few papers, but that they can provide a service and help that clinician feel more ready to take better care of their patients, as opposed to feeling someone just came and talked at me and they left me a pile of paper that I need to read in the 3 minutes that are unaccounted for when I might otherwise brush my teeth. And so from my primary care point of view, even though I spend a big chunk of my time working on NARCAD and related activities and thinking about the evidence, when I'm running behind in clinic and there's a patient with many problems and I'm realizing I'm not gonna have time to address them all, it's hard not to feel frustrated and burned out. And we have to recognize that when we're designing interventions. I think I think that's key. One of the challenges we face when we talk to people who are more senior in organizations about academic detailing, people who maybe are in the management of a large multi-practice group or a hospital network or an insurer, whether public or private, is how do you bring it to scale? Part of the appeal of academic detailing, the reason I like it as a primary care doctor, is it connects with my needs and my practice and how do I help my patients. But someone who's running a larger system will say, yes, but if I can't scale it instantly to a massive number of people, then I'm not so interested. And we sometimes struggle with how do we get them to see that argument that that this can be done at scale when people look at it and say, yes, but it's one-on-one, it can't. How do you think about that tough question?
Well, I guess I, in my darker moments, would want to ask that person, when you go to the doctor, do you want it to be scalable in a high-tech, low-touch way, or do you want to see your doctor one-on-one and have them pay attention to you? Because things are complicated in clinical practice, and the idea that, and we've had conversations as well about this with other groups outside of our little community of people who want to, you know, they should just pass a law, or put it all on the computer and let the computer tell the doctor what to do. Or isn't somebody in charge that could just make rules? And, you know, as it turns out, no, no, and no on that as well. And in this, but I'm not sure we ever want to get to a world in which all of this could just be put into some computer code, and then, you know, then you don't really need doctors. You just have the patient interfacing with a terminal, and the computer says what you should do. And I don't know how many of us would want to get our medical care like this. At the end of the day, primary care is about an interaction between one human being and another, and education about something as complicated as medicine ultimately ought to have something to do with a communication between one human being and another as well. So yeah, at the end of the day, a lot about medicine is a not super scalable human interaction, and that's one of the hardest and one of the best things about medicine. But I know that, as you know as well, Mike, when at our not-for-profit Losa Health, we train people to go out and talk to doctors. We try to convey to them the idea that you are providing a gift, a service, a way that will help them get through the day and take better care of their patients, and not we're going to give you another bunch of things that somebody's going to ding you about next week and say you didn't follow through, or a big stack of stuff you've got to read by tomorrow morning. But no, we're here to help, and there is this great tradition in medicine of one healthcare professional teaching another that we're trying to stay faithful to, and to try to make a very, very demanding job a little bit more doable. And if we can convince doctors that that's the origin and the goal, then I think we're halfway there in terms of getting that communication to happen.
I do think there are some places where, if not scalable in the way that widgets and computer programs can be scaled, there are things that we can try to do to increase the chances for academic detailing to be successful. Actually, that's some of what you and I and everybody who's worked on NARCAD over the last 7 years have been trying to think about how to do. Are there ways to more clearly identify the optimal strategies for implementing an academic detailing program if you're in a big system or a small system or a rural or an urban system, in ways that can be shared with people who are trying to start new programs so that they don't have to reinvent the wheel the way that existing programs did, so that they can learn from not just your original research studies, which were influential, but were in a research setting.
Right.
But that they can learn from groups like the Kaiser System in Northern California that's had a program, or international groups like the Australians who have a national system, and build off of their successes. Similarly, when people have identified the most clinically relevant evidence, are there ways that groups can share that knowledge so that you don't have many organizations each doing an individual evidence review from the ground up, but that there can be some shared knowledge, and then you can customize to give it that individual touch that you were talking about that doesn't scale so easily. So I agree with you. I think we can't scale it in the way that people think about scaling something that is more of a widget than a personal intervention like this. But I do think that there really is an opportunity for us to think about what are the shared lessons, where can we create efficiencies so that people who want to do academic detailing, organizations that want to do academic detailing, can have a leg up when they're starting it, and so that everybody who does it doesn't have to feel like, oh my goodness, I'm on my own doing something that no one's ever done before. Because thanks to the original studies from 40 years ago, there are now dozens of organizations and hundreds of people who've done it, and we really should be making their experiences a step up for everybody else.
Exactly, and that can, as you say, make it more efficient and lower the barriers to entry for a lot of groups that would like to do this. There's two points about scalability that might be worth mentioning. One is that in the end, one reason that there needs to be one-on-one interaction is that to really teach somebody something about a complicated topic, as we've seen over the years in our work, you really need to, in a sense, understand why is a given healthcare professional doing what he or she is doing. And some of our early experiences that in trying to teach a doctor how to treat problem X better, if you don't talk with him or her in an interactive way and say, why are you doing this? As, by the way, a good sales rep for a drug company does, and that's how we kind of learn in the beginning how to do this stuff, to say, tell me, Dr. Fisher, how do you manage a new patient with diabetes? Or why are you using this insulin and not that insulin? If I, as the educator, don't know why you're doing what you're doing or what your attitudes and beliefs are, I will not be able to give you the information that you particularly need. I could make you sit still for a canned speech, but it would not deal with your own particular needs as a learner and as a professional. So that's another reason. It's not just like we like to do things on a small scale, but things can be done on a small scale, on a large scale. That is, and this is the hopeful point about scalability, if we were to move toward a system of healthcare in which there are organizations responsible for the care of large numbers of people, like, for example, Kaiser has, or the Veterans Administration has, or many international healthcare systems have, or accountable care organizations might have in the US, there will be somebody to talk to say, hey, how'd you like to have your doctors have a regular opportunity to meet with a specially trained pharmacist, nurse, physician to get the best possible information about problem X? Would that be useful to your system and to your patients? And by the way, would you find that to add value and perhaps even be cost containing for you, which is something people tend to like to hear? If there were someone to talk to, as there is at a Kaiser or a VA or the Australian National Health Service, they would say, yes, of course, let's do that. And they indeed do. When everything is anarchic and happening in a very decentralized way, there's no one to talk to. But if our healthcare system, with whatever politics goes on or doesn't go on, moves toward a system of organizations of care, it might be possible, and it would be great to see this day not far in the future, where doctors are said, okay, for one of your ex-patient visit slots today, you're going to have the opportunity to just meet with an educator. We'll pay you for your time to do it, and you'll learn something, and that'll be better for everybody, and that's just part of your job description. That would be a world that I would love to be part of, and I hope that maybe one day that'll be the case.
I do think that organizations like accountable care organizations, or whatever they might be called as the healthcare system and health policy evolves, are going to be important. That's a trend we're seeing, as you say, Jerry, regardless of what's happening with healthcare policy or the healthcare system overall. And in those kinds of systems, for example, population health management is becoming really important as a task for all clinicians, especially generalists. It's something that they didn't necessarily know how to do from their training, and that they need to learn about, that they need to incorporate into their practice, and most importantly, that offers a chance to make their patients healthier and hopefully happier. And that's the kind of active education that we like to think academic detailing can provide. And I think these kind of structures provide a lot of interesting opportunities. For example, as systems become more integrated, there may be better opportunities for whoever is doing the academic detailing to help a physician look at the data on their patients and customize the academic detailing message to that clinician's needs and the kinds of patients who come in to see them in a much more precise way. And I think that can be a real service to patients. And those are the kind of topics that we want to keep thinking about with the groups that come to NARCAD for help. And they're the kind of new innovations on the older concepts that we'd love to see people making. And as we wrap up this podcast, Jerry, I'd like to give you the last word to think about what are the innovations or the new directions that you'd like to see in academic detailing over the coming months, years, and even decades.
It is an exciting time, as you mentioned, Mike, and it would be a mistake to think of academic detailing as something that's like pickled in formaldehyde from our early papers in the New England Journal in the 80s. It's got to change with the times and evolve. And you mentioned big data. I think data that can also be used to help identify which doctors might benefit the most from a particular kind of educational module without getting too big brothery about it. But, you know, hey, here's this Dr. Jones who seems to really be underutilizing statins or overutilizing antidepressants or whatever. That kind of epidemiologically guided education is a very exciting area now that data are becoming so ubiquitous. And the other issue, which we'll have to save for another time, is what is the role of academic detailing at a time when the believability and credibility of science is called into question on so many different fronts? How do you manage to make the case that we do have some inkling of the truth and it can be boiled down and there's ways of validating what's real, and we're here to share that with you?
Thanks for joining us for this episode of NARCAD's Core podcast series. We encourage you to join us for future podcasts. Visit us to see which episodes have aired at narcad.org. We also encourage you to visit our Learning Center, as well as our Best Practices blog and our conference and training series pages. If you have any questions about academic detailing, including a desire to reach out and partner with us, we're happy to help. Contact us at narcad@partners.org.